So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello Man fans, I'm Ollie Mann and this is The Modern Man, your monthly mix of trends, music, life stories and sex advice. And here is what we've got for you today.
Do I look like I'm enough for people? Do I look like I'll be feminine enough for people? Will people actually even believe that I'm trans?
Hormones, pronouns, surgeons and fetishists. What to expect when you're transitioning. Plus,
it is the law that condoms have to have at least a 5-year shelf life.
Alex Fox says it isn't sleazy being green, and Ollie Peart joins the Great Unwashed. It's all to come in this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and hello to Sarah in Dursley. Sarah, this isn't a dream. I really am talking to you now through your headphones. She says, hi Ollie, last night I dreamt I bumped into you at the bottom of a stairwell and gave you a fiver. Clearly my subconscious was feeling guilty for not having donated sooner. She has then transferred us a fiver on PayPal. Thank you, Sarah. A small price to pay, she says, for my favourite podcast, The Modern Man has pipped the Radio 4 food programme. Blimey. And I love my food. Really, that is high praise indeed, Sarah. My favourite podcast, genuinely one of my favourite podcast episodes every year, is that one they do at Christmas where a load of critics sit around and talk about their favourite cookbooks. I don't know what it is about a load of people I don't know discussing the photography from barbecue books that I can't see that I love so much, but I bloody love it. So that means a lot that we would displace them on your pod feed. Thank you. Loads of you getting in touch about the Zeitgeist last month, Mr. Peart's investigation of being child-free by choice. Gwen, for example, says, Ollie, I listened with huge interest to your discussion. I'm 25. When I was in my teens, I assumed I'd have kids by now, but I hated the idea of labour. I was downright terrified of having to birth a child. And in my early 20s, I researched into adoption. Only slowly did I realise, if I don't want to be a parent, I don't have to. I cannot express what a relief this realisation has been. Gwen, I'm very glad that you now know what you want. Or what you don't, I guess. Lottie, meanwhile, says, my husband and I don't want biological children because the part of parenting we want to experience is that of raising a child, not having our genetic material reproduced. I found it difficult to listen when you speculated about this potentially springing from something difficult in our childhoods. It's not the case for us at all. I think many people are just looking at what being a parent means rather than assuming conception is the path you have to take. And Heather says, I'm 46, I have autism. I've been firm in my child-free status since my mid-20s, but unlike some child-free people you discussed, I'm actually really interested in hearing about parenting and kids. I just feel about children the way I feel about dogs. I like spending time with them, and then I like giving them back to their parents. Thank you for all of those. And a big special thanks to those of you who have donated financially to the show this month. Honestly, we realise times are tight. We really appreciate it. Big, socially distant hugs and sloppy kisses through face masks to you all, including David Hutchinson, Megan Velo, Jill Pythian, Vivian Gollings, David Trainer, and Jali Chandra, and James Rhodes, our ambassador from Guam, who has redonated to the show. If you can afford to send us some cash in return for this podcast, we are independent, we're funded by your donations and some limited sponsorships, then please, please do head to our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, click Beer Money, and feel fucking great. Right, in this month's show, you will learn what Project Geldon is, you'll learn how long it takes to be seen by a gender dysphoria clinic, and you'll learn what Meg Matthews makes her bottles out of. Let's go. Time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested, with Ollie Peart.
Hi, Ollie.
For once, Ollie, I'm very pleased that we're remote recording this and not in the same room, because I don't have to smell you.
I don't actually smell.
Spoiler. Okay, well, you were worried last month that your hair would smell like a bin. That's a quote. Mm. So let's find out how you went with Dan from Suffolk's challenge, which was to explore the trend of people not washing their hair and to see if you could go a whole month without washing.
And but just to be clear, I have been washing my hands with soap.
Okay. I don't know how we managed not to say that last time, but yes, that's an important proviso during a global pandemic. Yes, mm-hmm. He was not asking you not to wash your hands. That would be foolish. But yes, this challenge was based on the idea that, well, firstly, not washing your hair is a trend. Is that really true?
Yeah, it is true. And actually, it's been around for quite a while. It's called the no poo movement. And the idea is that you don't use shampoo on your hair because people in the no poo movement believe that using chemicals in your hair, which is essentially what shampoo is bad for your hair, and it strips your hair of its natural oils, or sebum oil, as it's called, which is what's produced in your hair follicles. And besides, we've only been using shampoo like this since, like, the 1930s, so it's not very natural.
Yeah, we've only been using toothpaste for 200 years before that everyone's teeth fell out.
Yeah, that's different, though, isn't it? Because we eat a lot more sugary foods these days, so we kind of need the extra protection. But with hair, you don't. Nothing's really changed in the last 10,000 years.
Okay, and is there anything similar about your natural replenishing oils, which is supposedly the case amongst those who believe you shouldn't wash at all?
There is a sort of a train of thought similar to that of the no-poo movement, and it surrounds your skin microbiome. Yeah, so
what's,
you know,
that?
Like, well, you remember not that long ago, all these ads popping up, and it was about your gut bacteria, friendly bacteria and bad bacteria. And you had to basically drink yogurts to make sure that your poo came out. And this is basically the same idea. Look after your skin. Skin is the biggest organ in the body, for some, wink, wink. But you got to look after it. You got to look after your skin microbiome. And the same as the no poo movement, by washing it with soap and chemically stripping your body, you're stripping it of that natural
bacteria, but I presume it is the natural microbiome, which is the thing that smells if you don't wash yourself.
It's actually an area that's very poorly understood, and it's only now that scientists are starting to get a bit of an understanding of how important the skin's microbiome is. There's one chap in particular, a guy called Dr. James Hamblin, who's a lecturer at the Yale School of Public Health. He writes for The Atlantic, and he hasn't used soap for 5 years, right? He found that actually he smells a little bit more when he's stressed. And his theory, his idea is that your skin's microbiome and the way that it smells, whether that's bad or good or just neutral or normal, is actually another way in which we communicate with each other. So, you know, with your partner, for example, most partners would say, oh, my partner, I like the smell of my other half. It's a nice smell. I like how they smell. And it's just a way of communicating. And just by washing, we're stripping all of that away.
So what have you been doing for the last month? Because the challenge was don't wash at all.
Well, this smelly nerd, he uses water. I mean, this guy knows what he's talking about. So I didn't use soap, but I did use water.
Okay. I mean, that's a bit of a cop-out, but I don't blame you. I would do the same thing. So what's your usual bathroom routine? Do you use shower gel, soap?
I do. I've got, like, a bit of detail. I get eczema on like, my arm folds. So I use a product called Sanex, which is, like, it's not
so... the most Alan Partridge we've ever got during this segment.
But
I'm familiar with Sanex.
You know, yeah. Yes, but it is soap, it foams.
It's a neutralised shower gel, fine. Okay, so that's what you usually use, and you weren't using that.
And I wasn't using that.
So, element of jeopardy. Is the eczema in Ollie's folds going to come back?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a worry.
Okay.
No, genuinely, that's a worry. Like,
I'm
people
not,
with eczema
I'm not
try
minimizing
and manage
it.
You have to manage your eczema.
So, day one, what was it like?
In all fairness, the washing of the skin wasn't that weird. I just sort of rinsed myself off with water. It was the hair. Like, because you walk out of the hair and it feels just a bit matted. Because I use Head and Shoulders, 2-in-1. And when I step out of the shower...
You're a busy man, you're on the move.
Yeah, exactly. With Head and Shoulders, you step out of the shower and I have got smooth flowing locks. It's, you know, it's your L'Oreal moment, it's lovely. But I stepped out and, it's just matted.
And did you think, I'm not going to look like I want to?
Not really, but it's more about how you feel, actually. Because I don't like feeling gross. Like, if I feel a bit... And bearing in mind, you know, it was summer. We were in summer when we were going into this challenge. And also, if you remember, we went through an insane heat wave. Actually washed a couple of times a day on some of the days. Just with water, but because...
Because you weren't using soap?
Yes.
Did you have more body odour because you weren't using soap?
Initially, yes. I changed tack, you see. I read a little bit more from old James Hamblin, and he said, use a brush. What do you mean, Not a fucking dustpan and brush.
What kind of brush then? Like a,
just a brush, like
when you brush your hair with?
No, like a shower brush.
What do you mean a shower brush?
Ollie, Body Shop. You remember those wooden... brush?
Oh, I have seen those things. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
God. He was like, use one of those.
I can picture Donald Duck now, 1950s, doing it.
Exactly. It's really simple, actually, when you sort of like boil it down. If you think, when you're washing with soap, all you are doing when you're cleaning yourself is you're using chemicals to strip your body of any dirt.
Yes.
So the idea of using a brush, you're just changing the method of doing that. It's just a mechanical way of cleaning your body rather than using chemicals.
But, I mean, isn't there some friction? I mean, you haven't got the lathering, lubricating middle client there, have you?
It's actually quite nice. And then you feel exfoliated. I've got very, very smooth skin. I mean, even after the first couple of days. It's basically...
Did you brush your scrotum?
Yeah, okay. So you want some detail, don't you?
I mean, I think we're all here for this.
Logistically, it's borderline impossible to get up your crack and down by your balls, and it's quite painful. So, being the innovative chap that I am,
Why do I sense a Dragon's Den pitch?
Hey, listen, if it is a Dragon's Den pitch, I'd like to pose this one as the bum brush. Okay, the bum brush is basically a toothbrush. I used a toothbrush to clean my bits because it's perfect.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's perfect.
I mean, we're all stuck with that image now, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No, because it's good, because it's got the handle, so you can reach around without too much effort. You get good scrubbage going on down there. You can get behind your ball sack. So like the bit, you know, when they're dangling, the bit at the back, you can get a decent scrub in there.
Was there any danger that it would get confused for your oral hygiene brush?
No.
I mean, you must have made some really specific efforts in that department.
I did actually have... I did have a minor concern because whenever we... I don't know if you do this. I'm sure lots of people do this. But when you get an old toothbrush in your house...
Yeah, it becomes the bathroom scrubber.
It becomes the bathroom scrubber, right?
Yeah, so very useful for grouting tiles.
Yeah, and it's great for like limescale removal, all of that stuff. It's great for that.
This is the beginning of the bum brush pitch. So, this is what you'd say to Deborah Meaden.
Yeah, and I had to make it very, very clear to Pip, my other half, you cannot use that brush to clean the bathroom because I'm using that for my arsehole.
Was your concern, though, transferring the bathroom dirt to your bottom or vice versa or both?
I just don't want to de-limescale my arse, Ollie.
I'd
imagine it would sting quite a lot.
Okay, good. So you'd come up with your novel solution for that, and 14 days had passed. And, well, I mean, did your other half mention anything at all about odour or appearance?
No, and actually, I thought... Today, being the last day that I have to hold this up, thought I'd actually just ask her and say, look, you can be honest with me now. Was it a problem? And she said, the first couple of weeks, your hair was disgusting.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, she said that was horrible. And actually, one of the best ways to combat that, and this is a top tip, Ollie, top tip, is to brush your hair.
But not with the brush that you use for your arsehole.
Not the arsehole brush. You brush it with a normal
brush. Not the grouting brush.
No. Nope.
Not the toothbrush.
When your hair's
and
dry.
And not the shower brush.
Exactly.
A fifth brush.
You've got a fifth brush. Basically.
What else did she say?
And the bum brush is disgusting, having to look at
the
shower.
Yeah, it is disgusting.
That was basically the two things. But actually, she said you didn't smell. Now, we both admitted, and she did tell me at the time, that there were a couple of windows where I had some smelly pits. But that has eased, and I actually made my own deodorant.
I was going to ask about that, yeah. So if you've kind of interpreted this to mean a kind of no chemical, let's go green challenge, rather than literally let's not wash,
then
I presume it was open to you to put natural products onto your bits. So what did you make your deodorant from?
Coconut oil, baking soda, and cornstarch. Yeah. Mix it together. Ugh. And can I just say that...
I mean, it sounds like an amazing batter for chicken wings. It's not what I want my pits to smell of, I'm sorry.
No, but it just smells like coconut. Why would you not want your pits to smell like coconut?
Mm.
The deodorant actually works really, really well.
You know, the month's over now. Are any of these changes permanent?
I'm going to say semi-permanent, actually, because one of the things that it has made me realise is that I overwash. And I think a lot of us do.
One of the things that makes me feel like I live in the developed world is that I use a little bit too much product.
Yeah.
I definitely, like, it makes me feel sort of like I'm luxuriating to use probably too much, more than my body needs.
That's basically the one thing I would take away from this, is that I don't need to wash anywhere near as much as I was before. And actually, I'm going to just use a lot less soap and shampoo. Now, I said to you earlier that there was a little caveat. I did actually have to use shampoo and soap on one occasion midway through this challenge. But I feel I have a good excuse. My house flooded in a really bad rainstorm that we had, and there was sewage downstairs. Now, I don't care, right, what Dr. Hamblin says about your skin microbiome. There was no way it was going to fight off turds floating in my kitchen. So I was chemically stripping all
just
of that shit off.
With your little brush.
Yeah. My brush didn't stand a chance against that. So I immediately got in the shower and I was scrubbing with all the chemicals I could get my hands on.
If you've got a challenge that you would like to put to Ollie, of a trend you would like him to test out on the show, then do head over to our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and click feedback. And would you like to know what your challenge for next month is, Ollie?
Yes, of course.
It's from man fan Leanne in Aberdeen, who says, I read recently that 3 times as many people have started using Cameo over lockdown. So I thought it would be fun for Ollie to investigate what these people are using it for.
Cameo. It's celebrity videos, yes, or something.
So basically, I mean, the whole concept makes me a bit sad, but basically, right, it's people who were famous in the 80s mostly, and a few people off TikTok, who sell their services for a fixed fee.
Yeah.
Some of them it's like a tenner, some of them it's £100. And you pay them to, like, record a video message for you.
Right. Why?
Well, like, to say happy birthday, for example, would be a standard use of it.
It's like an easy way, when if you forget a birthday card, you can just... It's a cop-out. It's a red letter day, isn't it? That's what that is. It's like, fuck, what am I going to get them? I know. I'll get them this Ferrari ride around a racetrack that no one's ever heard of. Yeah.
So what I'm interested in Leanne's email is this suggestion of what else it can be used for.
Right.
Is there something other than birthday shout-outs that you'd use a celebrity from a soap opera to do? And what's in it for them, apart from the money? Like, you know, are people spreading love and happiness through this app or not? But anyway, it seems to me like the best way for you to really fully understand what's going on Cameo is to spend some money there.
Mm.
So we have put aside, and this is not to be sniffed at, I mean, we're not operating with New York Times budgets here. We put aside £200 of the show's budget.
Wow.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
I feel like Chris Tarrant. I am wire transferring you now, Ollie Pitt. £200.
Wow.
And what we want you to do is to find out the most creative way to spend that £200 on Cameo.
It'd actually be good to get a bit of inspiration and hear how other people have used this. So if our listeners have used it, and used it particularly in creative ways, I'd love to hear from you. Get in touch.
Yeah, at Ollie EP on Twitter, right?
That's me. You remembered, but I spell it right. Ollie EP.
Thank you, Ollie. See you next month.
See you next month.
In a moment, my interview with another of our listeners, Lexi. But first, our record of the month. And if, as a teenager, you enjoyed the work of Meatloaf or My Chemical Romance, I have a soft spot for both of those artists, then you will definitely enjoy this. It's been keeping me amused all summer. Our record of the month is Poisoned Heart, and the band is Creeper.
Me, I've got a poisoned heart. Right from the start, I have deceived you. And you, stay away from me. Cougar kills and dreams, I'll steal them from you. In the dark, I'll creep to your heart.
Now, as you know, we absolutely love to get man fans onto this show telling their stories. It is brilliant when listeners write in and nominate themselves for interview. And it, honestly, it's been a real privilege for me getting to meet so many of you over the years and hear your different and diverse experiences, some of which you've never shared anywhere. Here is an email that we received from man fan Lexi Perry Weston, who is trans. Hi, Ollie. When I started transitioning, I scoured the internet for answers. Everything was bad. I found that my NHS journey was extremely different to what I'd read online. I also found social transitioning and sexual transitioning very different too. I think it would be both extremely cool and helpful to be able to talk through my amazing, exciting, terrifying, difficult, and painful journey so that others can know what to expect rather than blindly worrying. Well, that certainly pricked up my ears. And so we got Lexi on a Zoom call. That's what you're about to hear. It's worth noting, of course, you know, her story is just one of many transitioning stories out there. It is one person's experience. And like many of our conversations on this show, it's very honest. It goes to some challenging places. Check the show notes for details on that. It starts, perhaps surprisingly, at an office party.
So it was in January, about 5 years ago, that I'd finished training at a new job. I wasn't out, I wasn't socially transitioned, I was still male presenting in every single way. In a January night in a not particularly nice area of town, went for a work night out and turned up in 7-inch blue heels that I still have but don't wear anymore, and the sort of like 50 style dress and ridiculous makeup, and everyone was a bit surprised, but no one seemed too fussed. And then,
wow, I mean, do you remember that decision? Do you remember getting dressed for that evening?
Yeah,
you were used to wearing women's clothing out but never with your workmates, and thinking this is going to stir some shit up, or I have no choice, I have to go like this. What were you thinking?
There had been bits of conversation at work, but nothing had sort of said, yeah, I am actually trans. And I sort of just thought, this needs to happen. It was like, I'll do this, and if I lose my job, I lose my job.
I mean, in your head, you must have been thinking, just please, not laughter, not catcalling, not gags.
Yeah, a few people were just like, oh, I'm really happy for you, you feel comfortable to come out like this. I was very, very surprised by how supportive everyone was. And obviously that led to them then encouraging me to sort of come out and transition at work, and they spoke to HR for me, and then everyone else knew I was trans before I did.
So when you next went to work, did you come in your male identity again?
Yeah, trousers, shirt, looking like a generic male. And then my trainer from that night out came over and said, I've spoken to HR, if you do want to sort of come in tomorrow, how you feel comfortable, just do it. So that's what I did.
That must have felt like an incredible change. You couldn't have been expecting that, even though it must have been nice for it to have happened.
It was one of the very few times I think a drunken night out has worked out changing my life for the better, I can say. I guess there's just a lot of pressure to fit in, and I was worried that if you do transition, then that's all anyone will ever see of you. And it's either they'll see you as a token minority, or they'll see you as someone who's going to potentially cause them problems by being trans and being a HR nightmare.
So how did you feel the first time that you walked into work as Lexi then?
Somewhere between absolutely terrified and ecstatic. It was the most awkward day of my life. I looked like absolute crap because I'd not really done makeup for work before, so everything was ridiculously overdone and I looked awful, and I just felt uncomfortable being at work but extremely comfortable that I didn't have to put on a pair of trousers that I hated just to be in a job.
And of course it's one thing, isn't it, with your colleagues who've already expressed support for you. It's another thing sort of going on the bus as Lexi for the first time, walking down the street.
Yeah, or as used to random people yelling shit at me on the street, so it wasn't unusual for me. I guess the severity just sort of ramps up when you're trans. Like, you just go to the shops and people would yell shit at you. People would...
Like what? Because I'd understand, you know, kids muttering under their breath. You know, I can't imagine someone shouting abuse at you. What sort of thing?
Oh, you're a disgusting faggot, or oh, you're a disgusting tranny. Oh, look at this person faking being a woman. It'd be that sort of stuff, but yelled. Like, kids actually weren't that bad because they would just ask their parents. But a lot of people felt very entitled to just shout what they thought at me. One of the things people always say when you come out as trans is, oh, that's so brave. And it's sort of like, well, it's not brave. You either transition or you kill yourself. That was sort of the reality of it for me. So when people are yelling shit at you, you just have to be like, fuck them, I'm doing this.
Okay, so you transitioned at work, but had you transitioned with your friends and family yet?
I hadn't at that time. It took me about a year or so to fully speak to my family, but they had a good indication already, so I don't think anything was too much of a surprise to them. I'd always worn skirts and dresses anyway, I guess, because I grew up, as painful as it is for me to remember, like, as a complete goth kid. So gender norms were already a bit skewed in that, so it gave me sort of the freedom to express my gender identity more.
Okay, so if we'd have met you when you were 12, 13, you'd have been dressed in the whole kind of, what, like Cradle of Filth gear, basically?
Wearing a black trench coat in 30-degree heat, yeah.
Okay. What was your name? What was your birth identity?
I don't give out my birth identity, my birth name.
Why?
It's irrelevant. It's dead to me. I've grieved over that part of my life. When I see things from that part of my life now, it doesn't even seem like me. I've seen pictures of myself and not even recognized myself because I'm just so dissociated with that part of my life, I guess. It's like when you hear a song that you haven't heard for ages and you're saying, oh yeah, I remember this. For me, it's like that. If someone talks about something, I'll remember it. But I don't think I really think about any of my pre-transition life unless it really comes into a normal, natural conversation.
So then you decided you wanted to transition surgically as well as socially. What did you do next?
I did what anyone does when they're not really sure of anything, which is I Googled it. I think I just put in how to transition, something very generic.
What did you see?
Just all sorts of crap about hormones, what you should take, who you should like listen to, how some clinicians were really terrible people, and how if you don't look feminine enough then you won't get treated. I guess for a lot of people it was a very negative experience for them. I mean, transitioning is relatively new in terms of actually being accepted for most people. I think I'm quite lucky that I am relatively accepted in transitioning, where for a lot of people, you weren't. And I think, I know that it was so different years ago that I think a lot of people are still sharing those opinions. Plus, in different countries, it's not as great. And I think people just feel like they need to voice that opinion more, whereas in the UK, in my experience, it was nothing like I could find online about how it works in the UK at all.
So what was it like? What was the first thing? I guess you go and see a GP.
Yeah, so I literally just sort of sat down and went, so I want to transition. And he just went, oh, okay. And then just went, I guess I'll do a referral for you. And that was it. And then it was receiving letters and waiting.
Waiting for how long?
For me, it was 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
And this is to a gender dysphoria clinic?
Yeah, I think most people just refer it as the gender clinic or the clinic for transgender health. But yeah, that's just for your initial appointment as well. So that might not actually lead to much for some people.
But the whole process, if you want to do it through the NHS, needs to be done in association with one of those clinics, doesn't it? So you have no choice but to wait for those 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, you have to wait.
You say that's just for your first consultation, so literally they didn't know anything about you apart from your name.
Yeah, and then the second appointment tends to be a few weeks later, which is with another clinician to sort of confirm that you sort of have the same story, that you are trans and sort of what stage you're at.
And what were you seeing as the end goal? I don't want to be indelicate about this, but I mean, you're talking about surgery as the end goal.
Yeah.
Talking about genital surgery.
Yeah, that was and is the end goal, really.
So for those 2 years that you're waiting for that consultation, that's two further years without that happening, where, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, did you feel any less like Lexi?
No, I think for me, I found the 2 years a bit positive. So before then, my life felt very up and down. Whereas for those 2 years, I had something to look forward to, and it helped me sort of explore myself more. And I guess it gave me the time to do that and to fully socially transition, have awkward conversations with people, and sort of deal with all that before I had the appointment. Coming out to my parents and saying, by the way, I'm your daughter now, and having to have conversations with them about how they should be referring to me. And then I guess the only reaction I remember from my mum was just, you're really going to struggle to find employment.
Did that hurt you when she said that?
I don't think it hurt me so much as made me question whether it was the right decision.
Because she genuinely obviously did feel it would be an obstacle.
Yeah, she definitely thought that it would stop me getting jobs, stop me getting promotions, that I would just be treated as sort of a token minority. So she was genuinely concerned about my livelihood.
What did you say to her?
It was sort of, I have to do this. I don't have a choice. It's this or I'll end up dead in the ground.
And your partner at the time, from his point of view, he was in a gay relationship.
Yeah.
And did he know that you were into, you know, wearing dresses and had a different identity that you were burgeoning into at all?
Yeah. When I met him, it was when I was at university. Like, makeup was part of my daily routine. Skirts and dresses were the mainstay of probably my wardrobe, except going to work. But it sort of very quickly soured and pretty much ended the relationship, which it was a very sort of shitty process, really.
So talk me through that first appointment when you did actually get through to the gender clinic and you had your first consultation. What happened?
They just sort of ask you when you decided to transition, ask you about sort of how comfortable you are with your genitals, if you have any hatred towards them, what your sex life's like, if you're comfortable with that. It's those sorts of questions. My clinician was just open with me and said, look, it's not like how it used to be. We just want to know where you are and help you transition in whatever way that is, whether it's surgery, not surgery, however it is you want to be yourself. I remember driving home. I'd got just outside of the city centre and I had to pull over and I cried for about an hour and a half. I just cried because it was so emotional just to actually feel like, yeah, this is actually gonna work and I'm gonna get to be me. After that appointment, it was the second one, and then for me that was starting hormone treatment, which starts off as just sort of tablets you take every day.
Were you similarly excited to be doing that, or did you have some reservations about basically putting drugs into your body?
Oh no, I was super hyped. I was like, yeah, within like a year I'll actually have boobs that aren't fake. And yeah, that was like the most exciting thing in the world for me. Most things I understood was it was like going through puberty again, and I would say that's pretty much the case. As things started developing, I noticed that the physical changes in my body, like genital shrink and you get breast development, I definitely started feeling more like myself and a lot happier.
How much more of your life will you go taking any kind of corrective medication?
The rest of my life.
Really?
When you start medically transitioning, because it can cause you to become sterile, you have to sign loads of forms and they have to explain all the effects. And when you start taking hormones, if you don't take them properly, that can also cause effects. So you sort of get told that you'll be on this probably for the rest of your life. The only thing you're not is the testosterone blocker, which post-surgery you obviously don't need anymore.
Once you're on the drugs, how long is it that you had to wait?
So I waited a year and a half. From what I know, I'm one of the fastest to go through.
Why? Why were you fast-tracked?
because I'd already socially transitioned, there weren't any obvious issues for me that were, it wasn't as if there were things that were complicating my feelings towards transitioning. There weren't any mental health problems caused by transitioning. So for me, there was no doubt that I was trans, I wanted to transition, and there would be no regret or negative effects if I did. When I actually was getting to the point of meeting my surgeon, it was, you have to choose which surgeon you're going to have. I went to the gender clinic one day and they just gave me a list of 4 names, I think, and said, research which one you would like to have performing your surgery.
How do you go about that? How do you research into surgeon? You're not on TripAdvisor.
No. It was the most surreal moment that I think I had in the whole of my trans life, was just being told I had to choose which surgeon, which person was going to cut me up. And I basically just relied on Reddit to point me to the right direction. And I ended up choosing the one I felt actually gave a shit about trans people the most. That was what it boiled down to for me. They set you down, talk to you about, well, they ask you how much you know about the actual surgery. Then they just talk you through exactly what happens in the surgery. You then get taken into another room and they basically just say, take your tights and underwear off. And then it's lots of tugging and pulling and measuring to see if you've got enough skin there to actually allow you to have the surgery, so that you'll have enough depth after surgery. It was an odd sensation. I don't think it's anything that anyone I know who's not trans can particularly relate to, but it's I don't think it was too exposing. You felt very comfortable there, I would say.
So when do you think you might get the surgery?
Mine sort of depends on COVID now, because it sort of delayed me getting laser hair removal done. So it's between 1 year and 3 years, I think. If it hadn't been for COVID, it probably would have been in about 1 year to 18 months.
How does it feel to know that it may still be 3 years until you've fully transitioned?
For me, I'm already a woman. I label myself as female on everything I do. So the transitioning isn't going to change that for me.
Do you feel very confident and comfortable now in female environments?
Yeah, I feel completely comfortable going in any female environments. Most of mine have been sort of just work related, and I guess going to a shop and trying on clothes, and no one's ever had issues. It might have been occasionally where someone said, would you mind using the disabled? And I tend to just do it, and just to make it easier for myself, because you sort of just have to choose your battles in the end, because if you fight every battle, it's very exhausting.
So what's the subtext there? Someone's seen you and twigged that you're trans, and they don't give the context, they just say, would you mind using the disabled changing area?
Yeah, I've had it in sort of like nightclubs before as well, where they'll just tell you you're only allowed to use the disabled toilet. It is bullshit, the whole bullshit of, you could just be faking being trans to see women. And it's like, no, like, no one does that. And there's no stats for that to back that up. It's just bullshit. I used to fight it really, really hard. Now I just tend to not ask anyone, and I'll just, if they say I have to use a disabled changing room, I'll just do it, because it's too exhausting to fight it all the time.
Do you think there's a sense of living up to other people's expectations of what being trans is?
Yeah, it sort of relates back to feeling like you have to look hyper feminine all the time. When you come out as trans, and I still get it now, where you just sort of feel like, do I look like I'm enough for people? Do I look like I'll be feminine enough for people? Will people actually even believe that I'm trans? And what do they actually think is trans, and am I fulfilling that? It's always been in the back of my mind whenever I've been out at all, like, am I trans enough for this? It was the same when I met my partner's friends, but dating, I guess it was harder. I think there were more misconceptions and about what being trans is when I was dating and living up to those standards.
Such as what?
I guess for a lot of people, when they think about trans people, a lot of really visible trans people are pretty people. For trans women, I guess I'm referring to, and they don't sort of think about the fact that actually the majority of trans people are just like the majority of non-trans people. We're just sort of your average looking people. They all think that we've had like facial feminizing surgery and we're all like stick thin, and you know, because we've had to try so hard to look female, when reality is not that at all. Dating when you're trans is very complicated. So I kept having a debate with myself as whether, like, you sign up to any dating app or website, like, whether you very openly say, hey, by the way, I'm trans, or if you don't, because realistically, in my head, it wasn't that relevant. But then you then had to have that awkward conversation down the line, and then there would be times if you were on a night out and you met someone you liked, you just sort of had to have that awkward conversation. So it gets very weird very quickly, and then there are those who just want to date trans people, and that's probably the worst bit.
Yeah, we've covered that on the show with Alex before. Trans people, particularly pre-surgery trans people, are fetishized as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might be good for the person who's looking for that exact thing. It makes you feel a bit like a product if you're the person who's being sold that way rather than just going on a date.
So I always thought, I'm not really like suffering gender dysphoria that much. I feel quite comfortable in what and who I am. And it wasn't until I started dating and actually meeting people who would date me for a few months just to get what they wanted out of it because they were trans fetishists that I really then started suffering with like a severe lack of confidence about my identity, really, as a trans woman.
Did you date any straight men who, when they went on a date with you, didn't know that you were trans?
Yeah, two. One person I went on a date with, it was just like a pub date, and they ended up talking about how you sometimes start talking to girls online and they're trans, and slated trans people for 20 minutes right in front of me. So I made out with him in the car park and then went, by the way, I'm trans, and just left.
What did he say?
He texted me and just sort of said, what the fuck? And then I just blocked his number and just ignored him.
And did you have any positive dating experiences in that time?
When you're trans, it's very easier to put barriers up about being trans and make it into this massive big deal that it doesn't have to be. But at the same time, you sort of just have to accept that for a lot of cisgender straight men, that being with a trans woman isn't always the right option for them, and that's okay. For me, when I met my current partner, they didn't know I was trans. We'd been talking for a few days. I told them, and they just went, okay, let's just go on a date.
What's it like on the phone? And I'm asking that because, of course, we're an audio podcast, and actually throughout this interview I've been looking at you, and on webcam you look like a woman. I'm talking to a woman. But, of course, people listening to this, you probably sound more trans than you look, if you see what I mean. Have you had the thing on the phone where you've had to correct the gender pronoun? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I work in a call centre, so I very often get, oh, thank you, sir, and I'm just like, damn, again. But I stopped caring. I know that my voice is male to androgynous. I did have vocal therapy, I think it was called, to make myself sound more female, but it just didn't really feel me. It felt very fake and artificial, and I didn't feel it really represented who I was. It represented, again, an ultra-feminine view on being trans, and I just... It's a lot of effort to remember to do that. I mean, it's like, it's so hard to just change your voice completely and do it all the time.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? That irony, really, that by trying to be more of yourself, you could end up acting a part.
Yeah. They said, like, you don't want to sound like some sort of like Barbie. You want to sound sort of like a voice that fits you naturally. But for me, it just sort of ended up feeling that I was faking who I was. I mean, my voice has changed. There's no question about it. Like, my voice used to be, like, the deepest voice you would ever think of for any guy. Like, my voice was that deep. So it's changed, but it's not as changed as perhaps people would think. And it's also not something that changes with medication, whereas a lot of people, me included, thought that that was something that just changed, but it doesn't.
What's your relationship like with your family now? Have they got used to you being Lexi?
Yeah, everyone's like completely used to it. Birthday cards are like for my daughter. It was a bit of a journey because it's a bit of remembering to call me daughter. It would be remembering to call me she, not he, when we were out. But it wasn't horrific. And I was very proud of my parents and how quickly they came to terms with it.
Was there an element of you asking them to take down old photos of you as well?
No, there's not really that much of me anyway.
Oh, because you're a goth.
This is true.
They're probably really pleased you're not a goth.
I mean, that's definitely true. I guess it's just like, it's not mine to tell them to take down. Like, if they've got photos of me, that's their memories. Like, when they have pictures of us at Christmas and stuff, it's not things I want hidden. It's just not stuff I actively want to look at. Like, my house has nothing from pre-transitioning except my graduation photo. My parents' house still has stuff of me as a kid because that's the family memories. Like, I've never needed to. It doesn't bother me, I guess.
What about childhood friends, even if you don't see them? I mean, on Facebook or whatever, is there an acceptance there? Or even a feeling of you're a bit of a novelty? You know, you're my trans friend?
I didn't keep in touch with anyone from my school at all. However, I then have had people add me for the same reason that you've just stated of being a novelty. It was people who'd get in touch with me and be like, oh yeah, look, you're trans now, you must be so happy, you look really good and blah blah blah.
Is that generally something that you have to be wary of?
Yeah, you do have to sort of work out if people want to know you because of who you are and what you stand for and your personality and your interests, or whether it's because, oh, they're trans, they have really interesting stories and they must be something I can talk about. And I've definitely found that I've had the latter. And again, I think that's something that came up more in dating than, I guess, in friendship. I mean, I had, I guess, two relationships that lasted for a couple of months last year that I thought were genuine relationships. And it turned out that both of those people were fetishists who wanted to be with me because I was trans, and actually in reality didn't really give a shit about who I was and would really try and hide the fact that they were dating me. One night we were in bed and they were just like, oh yeah, I've always wanted to try this stuff, but I was never into the gay stuff, so I thought this will fulfill everything I need. So that was, I guess, one experience. Another was just someone who wanted to just sort of be in control of a trans woman and care for them because they need to be looked after because they've got so much going on for them. It's something I've still never got my head around, but I encountered so many times of people sort of saying they'll make the decisions because they're the man, and because you're trans, you are less than them, so you sort of do what they want.
You said earlier that transitioning wasn't really a choice because it was that or take your own life. I assume you meant that literally. Have you ever had those feelings since you started transitioning?
Yeah. I've had sort of suicidal feelings / a suicide attempt since, due to a pretty poor experience I had, which is sort of related to being trans.
I don't want to make you talk about it if you don't want to.
Oh, I can talk about it. It's fine.
What happened?
I'd broken up with a guy, another shitty relationship, so I decided to just sort of go out and get with someone and just sort of get myself over it, or under it, so to speak. So I went back to someone's house. They were very aware I was trans, and because it was pretty much a hookup, I wasn't particularly bothered about it. I was just like, it's someone I'll never see again. And then sort of when I got there, it was I sort of changed my mind. I didn't want to do it. I sort of thought, this isn't going to help me get over the ending relationship I've had. But that person just, in their words, said, you're trans, you'll do what I want, you're a trans bitch, you'll do what I want, and decided no was no longer an option. And so just raped me, pretty much.
Have you spoken about this much before?
Yeah, I've had counselling for it. I went to the police, but I mean, there was no evidence either way, so I decided not to take it further. But I've been through rape counselling for it, and it's not something that affects me any longer to such a significant amount. But at the time before I got help, it was incredibly hard because they raped me because I was trans. It made it even harder for me to just accept myself as being trans and not think that that was always going to happen. Mm. There was definitely an element of thinking that, well, you're trans, so you know this is a risk, and you know that people, well, a lot of men will just use you for sex because they have a fetish for it. So it's your own fault. And then there was also the side of me thinking, well, this is always going to happen. I'm never going to be normal. I'm never have a normal relationship because I'm trans. I'm just this thing for people to use and get bored of. And that's how it felt for a long time.
It must be the most amazingly positive feeling to have a relationship now that's so different to that.
Yeah, it's still weird for me. Very weird. Like, actually not having to be uncomfortable about sex now is incredibly weird. I still cannot get used to it. My partner doesn't understand the big deal, but it very much is to me still.
And you said you just don't think about the earlier part of your life, about your former identity. So, I mean, Lexi, in a sense, is 5 years old.
Yeah.
What's been a great day as Lexi? When you look back on your life now, do you have happy memories?
I mean, it's a cliche, I guess, but just, I don't know, like going for the first date with my partner now, I guess that's one of the happiest times going out. Was we literally just went for drinks, stayed over where we live now, and I remember just how well I did my makeup for once, which I can never seem to get right ever again, and how my hair didn't look like a horrific mess for once, and I just looked really nice. And I do sort of love looking back at things like that, and I guess any times we've just been out and had a nice evening, I guess they're what my memories are now.
I mean, this has been a really odd experience for me interviewing you, because every bone in my body is telling me not to ask you the questions that I'm asking you. If I met you in public, if I noted that you were trans rather than just accepting you as a woman, like I say, to me, you're presenting as a woman anyway on this webcam. Do you feel comfortable with people asking you anything to do with... I mean, you know, no one asks me anything about my gender as a man. Certainly not people who don't know me.
I think there's two sides to this. So I'm very open about it because that's sort of how I've learned to deal with it. That's how I've learned to deal with people asking questions. And actually now I'm sort of quite happy to talk about it because it's the only way people can get educated if they don't understand things. Like at work, I've always been super open about it. And it also makes it easier if I'm having an off day in terms of sort of random people. I've had it before where someone's just sort of come up to me and touched part of my body and said, have you had surgery there yet? And
what?
Yeah, that's a bit harder to deal with, and I'm less okay with, because that's more invasive, I guess, when it's actually touching.
That's harassment. I mean, that is sexual harassment.
Yeah.
There will be people listening to this, obviously with this episode title in particular, who are trans or think that they want to transition. What are your top tips? What are the do's and don'ts that you've learned along the way?
I guess the most important do is just always remember to be true to yourself throughout the entire thing. Don't let other people's perceptions of what you should be change who you are. Never feel like you have to do something because you are trans for someone else's entertainment or pleasure or sexual pleasure. And I guess just have a shitload of patience, because there's a hell of a lot of waiting around being trans, but just use that time to explore who you are and what you're comfortable with and happy with, and try and make it as positive an experience as you can, because you are the only one who can.
Lexi Perry Weston. And remember, if you've been affected by the difficult issues that she was discussing, there's always someone to talk to. The number for the Samaritans is in our show notes. And if you're trans and Lexi's story either resonated with you or you have a different take on transitioning from your experiences, we'd love to hear from you too. Head to the feedback page at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Up next, your sex questions. Alex Fox will be searching for the Holy Grail, the biodegradable condom. Does it exist? Find out after this.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your questions of sex have never sounded so perky. It is time for The Foxhole with Alex Fox.
Hello, Ollie.
And yet, not wearing makeup today. And I would not raise that. I would not be so ungentlemanly to raise it. And in fact, I think you look great. But you mention it. And so I feel compelled to ask you why.
Yes, well, I did have to shower in a great hurry before logging on to our call today because for the second time, I managed to, in a rush trying to clear my house, I moved a large scented candle and basically did an amateur attempt at embalming myself.
Whoa. You spilt it over your face?
No, I spilt it all over my carpeted floor, all over a suitcase, all down my front. It splashed back into my hair. I had it in my eyelashes.
How?
I was so covered in wax that there are medieval letters with the family crest stamps onto them that are jealous of the amount that I was covered with.
Sure. I didn't even ask what an Alex Fox scented candle smells of, but I don't know if I want to know.
No, thankfully, it's honey nectar. It doesn't smell of my vagina or anyone else's.
Time for your questions of sex, anyway. And it's this from an anonymous lady who says, Alex, please can you give me some advice on how to be more eco-friendly when having sex? My partner and I are very environmentally conscious and have been trying to shop ethically using zero waste shops and switching to plastic-free brands. However, I can't help but notice that this is less easily managed in the bedroom. We've recently started using condoms again after giving up with hormonal contraception. I've tried the copper Mirena coil as well as several pills. And although condoms are currently working well for us, I can't help but notice the unnecessary waste it creates. Is there a plastic-free or eco-friendly version of a condom? And if so, is it still as effective? Now, I should preface your answer, Alex, by saying we did answer a similar question in 2017, Series 3, Episode 10, if you want to go and check it out. And your solution to the person who wrote in then was lambskin condoms and solar-powered dildos. What's new?
Yes, we have covered eco-sex issues a little bit before. I think I remember talking about Nobessence, highly polished wooden butt plugs and, yeah, recycling your sex toys. I took this opportunity to do a really deep delve into the world of eco-condoms and get super geeky because this is actually a great excuse. I've had some burning questions about the biodegradability of condoms. I had a sneaky suspicion. Having seen more and more condoms advertised as being green, there seemed to be an assumption that because they involved latex as an ingredient that they would biodegrade. So I spoke to Gabrielle Lodds, who's from a relatively new company called the Green Condom Club. And she had also clocked a real lack of transparency about ingredients and manufacturing processes in the condom world. Now, because a condom is a medical device...
Transparency is one of the things I do look for when buying a condom.
Yeah, because condoms are a medical device, that means that they're not obliged by law to reveal the ingredients that go into them. And Gabrielle quite rightly pointed out that if you're somebody who is concerned with ecological ethics and you want to know what's going into, say, the skincare cream that's going on your face, then you might rightly also want to know what's going into your other place, especially when you consider that the vagina is full of mucous membranes, which makes it it can absorb things very easily. You've got heat going on there. You've got friction during sex. If there are yeast infections or any like micro tears or anything. But basically, there is so much going on in that area of the body that means it could be hypersensitive to chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, there is no other sort of situation where people are so willing to just insert some unknown plastic substance into an open crevice on their body, is there? But it's become something we've all become very accustomed to.
Exactly. Basically, if you are looking for a condom that biodegrades in the way that maybe you'd expect your carrot peelings or your vegetable scraps to break down in your compost box, that currently does not exist. And in a way, that's a good thing because you don't want your condom to biodegrade too fast. It has to be fairly robust to provide a full barrier between two bodies. And if you factor in the knowledge that vaginal fluids are slightly acidic, you've got a different pH of semen. Again, you've got all of that friction.
And also how long they can stay in a drawer.
Well,
I mean, you know, if you're buying a large pack, it could be a couple of years, couldn't it, in some scenarios? And, you know, that's not something that you're going to want to be worried about degrading.
No, in fact, it is the law that condoms have to have at least a 5-year shelf life. So it's quite difficult to make something that will magically biodegrade when you're done with it, but also has the qualities to last as long as is required of it by law. And that is why there's maybe some vagueness and greenwashing going on. Latex sap can biodegrade under the right conditions. It ideally needs quite a lot of oxygen, so it needs to be open to the air and the right temperatures. Those circumstances aren't always present in, say, landfill. So you might pop your condom in the bin thinking, this is fine, it's going to rot. Actually, it could take 4-5 years or longer. If you're really concerned about your condoms biodegrading, perhaps the best way to deal with them is to put them in your own compost heap. If you are lucky enough and privileged enough to be able to have one, I live in a first floor flat. I think if I started up some kind of personal condom compost facility in where I live, that would not be looked upon kindly by my neighbours whatsoever. But even then, there's no guarantee that they're going to break down quickly. If you live somewhere, say, like Alaska, that's very cold, then your condom and all of its contents could be hanging around for quite some time. You've also got the packaging to think about. Those little foil packets that condoms come in have to be plastic coated to make them resilient and protective enough for real world usage. As much as sex educators bang on that you shouldn't keep condoms in your wallet, you should keep them in a tiny tin, etc., etc., we know that most people do just pop one in their purse. They sit on it. It's at the bottom of a handbag for a long time. The wrappers have to be able to deal with that. And again, you have legal constraints here. You have quality control that such products have to live up to. So we don't have a solution yet for a fully recyclable packet. The boxes.
So is anyone working on this stuff?
There's quite a lot of investment being made in something called tough hydrogels. Now, hydrogels are made from materials that consist mostly of water held together by molecular chains called polymers. We already have hydrogels in the world working now in the form of soft contact lenses that allow your eyes to breathe because they're predominantly made of H2O, so they get along with the surface of the eye. Those are notoriously quite delicate, though, so they wouldn't be suitable for use in a condom. But there's a project called Project Geldom going on in Australia where scientists are trying to make a tougher, stretchier membrane that feels very much like skin or tissue that you can just wrap around your wang. Millions of dollars have gone into it. Unfortunately, because of all the medical testing that has to go on, the understandably strident stipulations on quality control with things like this, it takes a long time and a lot of money for real progress to be made. One of the testing criteria at the moment for hydrogels, tough hydrogels, is actually whether or not they're effective at blocking the transmission of sperm, bacteria and viruses. So we're still fairly low.
That's an important one.
Yeah, exactly. We're still fairly low down on the chain of progress there. Some limited progress has been made in the outside packaging. So you've got recycled cardboard boxes. You've got wrappers now made from cornstarches. Some lubricant companies, for example, Meg Matthews has a range called Meg's Menopause. All of her bottles are made from the byproducts of sugarcane manufacture, which make them a lot more ecologically sound. So there are baby steps being taken here.
But then that can be good, can't it? Brands trying to make a difference, but then they're accused, as you started by saying, of greenwashing, aren't they? If the core product itself is still something that legally cannot biodegrade. So it's sort of between a rock and a hard place in a way.
Well, that's where condoms live. Hard places are their natural habitat. I absolutely applaud companies making real steps within the confines of this particular manufacturing process to genuinely do what they can. I think that's different to misrepresenting a product as being super green and biodegradable when in fact that product may well be hanging around for years and years and years. A rubber condom ultimately still is better for the environment than one made of plastics like polyisoprene. Most condoms are made from natural rubber latex, but what you might want to do is look out for those that don't have lots of additional ingredients. So you maybe don't want ones that have got parabens in or spermicide or benzocaine, which is a mild anesthetic that's used in numbing condoms that are designed to help men last a bit longer in bed. There are condom companies as well that are making moves to do things that are good for the world and good for humanity in other ways. For example, there's one called Sustain, which has certified B Corporation status, and that's a legal standard that means the business interests of investors balance with those of the environment, their employees and their customers.
So condom offsetting, basically.
yeah, pretty much.
The idea. Okay.
And there's another company called Sir Richard's, brilliant. They're vegan condoms, and for everyone sold, they donate one in the developing world. There are lube companies like Good Clean Love, who produce the world's first ever carbon neutral lubricant. And on that note, actually, another vote for one of my most favoured sex toy companies. Doxy wand vibrators are made in Cornwall, so there are no air miles personally for me to provide jumbo jet power to my clip.
If you have a question of sex for Alex Fox, you need to send it through via our website modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and click on the feedback form. And if you want to follow Alex on social media, where can we find you?
I am at Alex Fox, spelled A-L-I-X-F-O-X.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this month's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new Manbassador. It is Jake from Bolton, whose partner Mags says, "Ollie, we've been huge fans of your show for 3 years. We recommend you to anyone looking for a new podcast and have finally got around to sending you some beer money." Thanks. We would be over the moon if you would consider Jake as Manbassador for his hometown of Bolton. Even though we don't live there anymore, it's where we met and where our love for the Modern Man began. Feels like a wedding speech. I'm welling up. Jake, I now appoint you Manbassador for Bolton. Congratulations. That's it for now. Our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we will see you with something new on October the 10th.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.